These are my skinny arms. My limbs. My skin, he sees. It is thrilling. The sudden realization that beneath the layers of cloth, she has a body, a beat, a drum. He gives her the kind of smile that girls gather in the bathroom to talk about, hooks his arm around Amar's neck and says to her,
Your brother's not so bad, you know.
Your brother, he said. Your. He announces to the few other boys that remain in the hallway that Amar will be on his team from now on. He pulls Amar closer to him for a moment before letting go. And it is that subtle display of affection for her younger brother that makes Hadia look at him in another way, aware of not only his eyes and how startling they are, or how he makes everyone in their Sunday school classes laugh, but also of how kind he is, how good. Amar has a stunned look he tries to conceal. He busies himself by kicking his shoes into a cubby, smiling the whole time to himself. The eldest Ali boy walks into the corridor and heads to the Quran class that Hadia will soon be late to. Lately, Amar has had a rough time at school and difficulty keeping friends. Toward the end of last year, his grades had plummeted like never before. He had lost what little motivation he might have possessed. And his third grade teacher decided it would be best for him to repeat the year, considering he had done terribly on almost every single test. He has just begun third grade again. Amar looks at her, and his smile widens before he rushes to his own class. She stands in the empty lobby, taking in the silence and the scattered shoes. When she enters the classroom, she spots the only empty seat, in the front row of the girls' section, just behind the four rows of boys' desks. The boys have the first few rows reserved, so that the order of the classroom may be maintained, so they cannot look at the backs of the girls at their desks and get distracted. Girls are not like boys, they are told. Girls have control over their desires. It is up to the girls to do what they can to protect the boys from sin. Sister Mehvish, their Arabic teacher, is the strictest of them all. She has a thick Arabic accent and a mole the size of a little grape on her upper lip.
So gracious of you to join us, Sister Hadia, Sister Mehvish says. Why don't you begin our class by reciting the surah you had to memorize?
Everyone turns to look at her. Her face burns when she sees that the eldest Ali boy is looking too. Hadia confesses she was unable to finish memorizing the surah. A lie, she tells, to save herself from the greater embarrassment of having to recite it aloud, drawing even more attention to herself, risking the possibility of fumbling the correct pronunciation, and the look she knows she will get from the other students who, as usual, have not bothered to memorize it at all.
Of course you didn't, Sister Mehvish says,
and some of the students snicker. The only empty seat is directly behind the eldest Ali boys. He leans back in his chair, turns to face her when she sits, and she catches some sympathy in his eyes. But by the time she has settled and he has turned to face the teacher, she realizes it could easily have been pity. He rocks in his chair throughout the lesson, taps his pen against his blank binder paper, and she finds it hard to concentrate on the Arabic words Sister Mehvish is writing on the chalkboard. She remembers his arm around Amar, the points he scored, the moment he looked to her from the court, the vein in his neck, the skin revealed when he lifted his shirt. She feels instantly and intensely guilty for storing away that brief glimpse of his skin, especially ashamed that it has come back to her in a class for learning the holy language, holy texts. She does not recognize herself, and tugging on her loose sleeve so it covers her hands, she does not know if she likes herself. But he has a small speck of a birthmark where his hair meets his neck in the shape of a strawberry, and every so often, he runs his hand through his hair, then lets his hand rest at the back of his head. So close that she would hardly have to stretch to touch him if she dared. Twice, she thinks he will turn to look at her. But he does not. When the class is over, everyone stands, no one faster than Hadia. The eldest Ali boy turns to her, nods towards Sister Mehvish, and rolls his eyes. That drum in her body again. Sister Mehvish has her back turned to the class and is erasing the words that look like scribbles from the board, creating a cloud of white dust. Hadia looks back at him. He has not looked away from her. He pulls an almost empty packet of gum out from his pocket and removes the last piece, a stick wrapped in silver foil, and extends it to her, his palm open, his eyebrows raised. Hadia reaches for it. Her fingers lightly graze the surface of his palm. She wants to say thank you, but does not. She can feel her face getting warmer. She fears he will notice a change in color. So she offers a small, quick smile and walks away. Her classmates have not noticed, and Hadia looks up to where she imagines God is, sometimes a spot on the ceiling, other times a patch of brilliant blue in the sky, to thank him for the moment passed unseen. She doesn't want to be the subject of the next story they share in the bathroom. Did you see how he offered Hadia a stick of gum? In the corridor light, the silver wrapping of the gum gleams. She tucks it into her pocket, like a secret. That evening, she sits in the living room armchair and runs her finger over half of the silver gum wrapper in her hand. The other half is taped to the ceiling above her bed, the interior inside out, so the white blends with the ceiling paint, unnoticed. On it, she had drawn a small strawberry. Most days even she would not notice it there, but there it would be. Her mother is setting the table for dinner. The smell of keema and fried tomatoes sizzling fills the room. Amar is bothering Baba while Baba is trying to read the newspaper. "Why don't you wear it every day?" Amar asks Baba, pointing to the watch on his wrist. It had belonged to Baba's father, their Dada. They asked to be shown it some nights because it was the only piece of Baba that had been there since before them, and because Baba was proud when he lifted it from the box to polish it. Dada was a mystery to them, just a photograph in Baba's office, or the few anecdotes Baba would share. And so the watch itself felt like a mystery, kept in its box, unless Baba wore it. "It still feels like my father's," Baba says to Amar. "I just inherited it when my Baba passed away. It had been a gift to my father from his father."
"Does it always go to fathers?" Amar asks.
"You mean sons," Baba says. Hadia knows the story. The watch had been gifted to her grandfather when he went to Cambridge to study law. Her great-grandfather had wanted his son to have a Swiss watch, like the men with whom he imagined his son would be studying.
"Hardly anyone studied in England then," Baba tells him. "He returned home a lawyer."
Baba flips the page of the newspaper and then extends his arm to Amar so he can get a closer look. Baba says to him,
"This watch will work forever. It will never stop."
Hadia smiles from her couch. She likes thinking of her ancestors as people who had done something with their lives, that her grandfather had been brave to study in England, and that her father had been brave to move here, each of them doing what they could so that she and her siblings could now be brave in their life.
"Where are you lost?" Mama snaps at her in Urdu. "Put water on the table."
Hadia stands reluctantly to help her mother. Huda is setting the table slowly. Huda was lazy with her tasks,
It was always apparent when she did not care about what she was doing. Hadia's efforts never changed. She was determined to do everything well, even the tasks she hated. Amar refused to approach what he did not care for at all. But when he did care, he put more of himself into the task than Hadia ever could. Amar begins to throw pillows into the air before catching them. Baba continues reading. He has an angry look on his face, and he is moving his hand up and down his eyebrow. And she wonders what is happening in the world that is worrying him. Hadia brings down the jug and fills it with ice and then water, listens to the way the cubes begin to crackle, which is her favorite part of this task. Amar is excited in a way that he is usually not, and she wonders if it is because he was included with the older boys today. Sometimes Amar acts so despondent that Hadia wants to hold onto his shoulders and tell him to stop. He never seems to enjoy being at home, but complains whenever he is dragged to school, to Sunday school, to mosque on weeknights. He complains until something in their father snaps and he strikes at Amar, with a look, a sharp shout, sometimes a hand. A reaction that silences his protests, but alters nothing in his attitude. She is beginning to wonder if Amar acts this way on purpose, just to see how angry he can make Baba. Mama and Baba have gone to countless appointments with his teachers, but little has changed, and Hadia often overhears them talking about him on the other side of their bedroom door. But tonight, Amar offers to help their mother. Mama looks to him and smiles.
You don't have to today, Mama says, because you were so good to ask.
It is a line she has never heard from her mother. That everyone in her family is occupying the same space, and that none of them knows about the silver gum wrapper in Hadia's pocket, or where her mind goes, is intensely pleasing to her. She thinks of Abbas Ali, of the color of his eyes, hazel, striking against his lightly tanned skin, a rarity in their community. Everyone is fascinated by the Ali family, their wealth and their stature. How they came from a line of esteemed scholars and politicians, their latest and loveliest fashions. But Hadia has noticed with sad curiosity how often positive things about them were discussed in a negative tone. When she first began to understand jealousy, it was the comments she had heard Mama say to Baba about Seema Auntie that came to mind. Did you see the purse she was holding? It is haram, that kind of excessiveness. Did you notice how highly she spoke of her children's independence, without once mentioning it is only because she is always at work? If she doesn't wear hijab, how will she ever expect her daughter to? Always a different lipstick shade, sunglasses atop her head, blue jeans. Beauty is meant to be concealed, not indulged in. And yet, not one community member ever turned down an invitation to the Ali's home, nor did anyone deny themselves the pleasure of their presence at their own parties, a presence that made them feel both big and small at the same time. She wasn't sure what the parents did exactly, how they had so much money. The father was a doctor of a special kind. The mother designed clothes in India before moving to California, and she had continued doing so in the garage of their home until the business flourished. She owned stores across the states. She was one of the few mothers who was successful at work. Most mothers stayed at home. Almost all of Hadia's and Huda's Indian clothes had been bought from her boutiques. Overpriced, her mother would say, before purchasing it anyway, because their family and many others in the community always received a discount. Seema Auntie was never in the store, which made Hadia wonder exactly what it was that she did. There were four children in the family, three sons and one daughter, Amira Ali, a pretty and charming 7-year-old girl, with dark hair and rounded eyes, hazel, the exact hue of her brother's. Many of the older community girls were kind to her, and the adults too, because she spoke fluent Urdu and was not afraid to be witty, to joke with them as if she were their age, and she had not yet reached the age when that would be considered rude, when they would begin to discourage that kind of banter. She was not told to shush like other girls were. Hadia wondered if the girls her age were kind to her in the hope that her older brother would one day notice them. For this reason, Hadia was only as nice to her as she would be to any other girl, extending no special treatment. The other boys of the family, Kumail and Saif, were fine enough, but they were shadows of their eldest brother, Abbas. They often walked on either side of him, and all three of them banded together to protect Amira, which was another reason why no one dared to treat her unkindly. Once a boy had been throwing things in the corridors of the mosque, and something hit her. A small gash appeared at the edge of her eyebrow. Everyone still exaggerated the blood, Amira's cries, and the reaction of the eldest Ali boy who, rumor had it, pushed the boy against the wall and threatened to knock his teeth out if he ever threw anything in the hallways again. But Hadia did not like to think of him in that way, as someone with a temper. She liked to think of him walking with his little sister on his shoulders, as she sometimes saw them do, and how Amira would hold on to his neck, and how this too had endeared him to Hadia. How, of course, she could care for a boy who knew how to be kind to a sister. Of course, someone like that would be safe to love. Amar walks up to her on tiptoe and announces, "I'm taller than you now." He sticks his chest out and holds his hand to his forehead as if to salute her. Hadia pushes him a little so he falls back on both feet. "No, you're not," she says. The day her younger brother would grow taller than her loomed. She knew it would be a strange, embarrassing transition, and she feared it would also transform the way they thought of one another, related to one another. "Am too," he says. Mama notices their quibble. She stops pouring the tomato dish into a clear bowl and wipes her hand on a towel. "All right then," she says, and she forces them to stand back to back. Amar complies eagerly, his new confidence already beginning to annoy her. Huda stops putting the plates on the table to watch. The crinkle of a turning newspaper page cuts the air. Hadia looks to the ceiling and sends a quick, short prayer to God. "Please do not let him grow taller than me just yet." After placing her hand on both of their heads and shoulders, stepping close to them and then farther away, Mama declares, "Hadia is still taller, but not for very long." Mama winks at Amar, and he leaps into the air. Mama catches him in her arms and tussles his hair before walking back into the kitchen. Hadia rolls her eyes and turns to busy herself with the task of filling glasses with water, but not before noticing Baba, still staring at the newspaper spread out before him on the coffee table. He is smiling to himself in a way Hadia has not seen before, gentle and grateful even, for the newfound height of his son. Amar cannot stop thinking of Amira and their unfinished conversation. He wonders if he is the only one who has returned to their exchange, and if they will have another like it. He wants to call Abbas, just so he can go over to their house, glimpse her walking across the landing, but he decides against it. He cares too sincerely for Abbas to seek him out for a false reason. Instead, he shoots hoops in his front yard, returns to their questions and answers, and catalogues what he now knows. She loves mornings. She stares out of her window at a single streetlight when she cannot sleep. She is brave, and, because of this, beautiful. Days pass, and his mother begins to plan a jashan for Hadia, who will soon be on break from college. 3 years ago, Hadia was accepted into a combined undergraduate and pre-med program, with the possibility of continuing on to med school under the condition that she work hard and distinguish herself. Recently, she had called home with the news that she had gotten the grades and test scores and faculty recommendations necessary to continue. His parents are so proud of her. He overhears his father talk about her any chance he gets to family friends who visit, or to the grocery store clerk who asks a simple question out of courtesy. Even Mama calls Sara Khala on the phone and brags and brags, but they never tell Hadia. Only say to her, good, that is good, finish soon and come home again. Amar never shows his parents his report cards. He only hopes to do well enough to graduate. Thinking of his future sometimes felt like looking down a long tunnel. And even if he squinted, he could hardly picture what his life would be like when he stepped out at the other end. Usually he hated when his mother threw a party. How she fretted over their house, how she made them clean their rooms. He protested that no one ever ventured inside their bedrooms, but to no avail. He especially detested how it fell on him to entertain the guests, when all he wanted to do was stay in his bedroom until everyone left, or sneak off with the boss and Kumail, and take just one drag. But this time, the news of the party piques his interest. Twice he asks his mother to clarify the date. First, to mark it on his calendar, a little red X. The second time, to make absolutely sure he got the day right. 14 days until the party. On day 11, he gets his hair cut, knowing how terrible he looks the first few days after a new one. The last 10 days take the longest to pass. When only 3 days remain, he gathers the courage he needs to find his mother in the kitchen. Which families are invited? He asks, gripping the edge of the counter, trying to appear as nonchalant as possible, knowing how unlike him it is to do anything other than complain. His mother is kneading dough for roti in a large silver bowl. Her cheeks are dusty with flour, her hair pulled back in a tight bun. He had assumed Amira's family would be invited. But earlier today, he panicked, and now he has to confirm, just to make sure his haircutting and hoping have not been a waste. Mama takes her time answering, moves strands of her hair from her face with the back of her hand, leaving behind another streak of flour, graying her eyebrow. His pulse quickens. He is surprised at the insistence of his own heartbeat. He twists his mouth to hide his nervousness. Why do you ask? She glances up at him. He shrugs one shoulder. Mama smiles. She resumes kneading the dough. He regrets asking immediately. She must know. She always knows everything. She begins to list the families invited, raising a dusty finger each time. But none of the last names are Amira's. She stops speaking and sprinkles more flour into the bowl, a trick for when the dough is too sticky. He turns to walk away and fills with a disappointment or deflation he cannot precisely define. Oh, his mother calls after him. I forgot one. He turns around and she is smiling at him in her knowing way. She says, the Ali family. Amar nods and walks away as calmly as he can, raises his fist in the air as soon as he is out of her sight. On the day itself, he irons his clothes for the first time in his life. It confuses him, the knobs and the different settings. He rushes to finish before his mother is done showering. He cannot risk any more of her knowing glances, her embarrassing smile. He is ready an hour before the function begins. Another first. He asks his mother if she needs any help, just to have something to occupy his hands. She beams at him.
For her, he pours cold mango lassi into plastic cups and arranges them on trays. He lounges in the living room near the entrance, though the party is outside, the men on one side of the garden, the women on the other side, or in the family room. Every time the doorbell rings, he looks to the door. Every time it is anyone but her family, he feels pathetic. Hadia enters the kitchen, dressed in a baby blue shalwar kameez that drags to the floor. She looks nervous, knowing that the event is for her. She twists her watch on her wrist. Home is home when Hadia is in it. Amar offers her a cup of lassi and she takes it. Whenever Hadia visits, Huda and Amar remember that they are friends too, and the three of them gather in her bedroom, stay up late talking, or they take their homework to a cafe just to be near her. Huda appears, puts her arm around Hadia, and tilts her head quizzically to one side as she takes Amar in.
Someone looks good today, Huda teases him.
He fills a cup and places it on the tray. Then another.
No better than any other day, he says.
His sisters watch him. Huda grins. He takes a sip. Then their doorbell rings, and he looks up, and Mama opens the door, and it is her family. He tries to meet Amira's eyes without making it appear as though he's trying, but she follows her mother straight into the garden with a lowered gaze. Tables have been set up in the backyard, some for the ladies, some for the gentlemen. All afternoon he is aware of where she is. There is a gravity about her, and he finds he is not the only one pulled into her orbit. A group of other girls surround her. Even the older girls lean into her. When she speaks, they listen, ready to laugh. She affords whomever she is speaking to her entire attention. Once he overhears an elderly lady comment how pyari she looks, a word that he knows means lovely. She is wearing a red and orange shalwar kameez. A delicate red orni is wrapped around her neck. Her lips have been painted red. This is new. He sulks about the garden, upset that they cannot be alone. A few of his friends are there too, but he engages in conversations with them as if he is only overhearing them.
Time for a walk?
Abbas asks, their code for sneaking away for a smoke.
Baba would be mad, he says, shaking his head, which is true in a way, but not the reason he does not want to leave, not even for a minute.
Abbas watches him a moment longer, in that same suspicious way Huda just had. And Amar wonders how he can be so transformed by his thoughts that his closest friend and sister notice instantly. Amira stands at the farthest edge of the garden, by Mama's mint plants. A breeze lifts her hair, then lets it go. A cloud moves over the sun, and the entire world is shifted. Why had he expected it to be any other way? He's upset, too, that it is clear to him now that he has constructed this all in his head, that to her, he is no one, at most just a friend of her brother's. Despite the disappointment, he cannot deny how his garden is changed just by her being there. The air changed. The charge of his body moving through it changed. There is even delight in knowing that Huda and Abbas noted that change within him. So she does not speak to him. She does not even lift her eyes to his. So she does not smile. It is still a pleasure feeling this way, inhabiting this space he has lived in for years without a modicum of enchantment. For once, he does not wish that everyone would leave as soon as possible. But as the sun begins to set, they gather their coats and adjust their scarves and approach his mother to thank her for a wonderful afternoon, and one by one, they go. The last moments of the day always make him uneasy. The changing color of the sky,
the empty feeling of knowing another day is about to be swallowed by the dark. Even in this, he is so separate from his father, who waits for dusk to step out for his walk, either around the backyard or to the horse pasture streets away, looking up at the world as though its wonders were made to be beheld by him alone. Her family leaves, and she leaves with them. The garden is just a garden. The living room, just a living room. The long hall up the staircase. The sound of the door shutting behind him. Alone again in his bedroom, that is just a bedroom. Something white on his pillow catches his eye. It is a piece of paper folded into a tiny square. He unfolds it. It has been carefully ripped, as though it had been pressed down with a nail before being torn, and its edges are softened. He does not recognize the handwriting, but appreciates its neat, measured quality before reading it. It says, "I'm afraid to lose my capacity to feel, to really feel. A. P.S. What's it like?" At first he is confused. Then it hits him. She is answering the question her mother had interrupted. She wants to continue their conversation. He reads it again. Then again. Then one more time. Then he sits at his desk and takes out a blank sheet of paper and a fine-tip black pen. Hadia wakes to a paper taped on her door. A drawing of a boy playing basketball, wearing red shoes, and jumping impossibly high. Soon she realizes that posters just like it have been taped on every bare wall, on both sides of every door, even on the door of their parents' bedroom. Some posters are simple, drawings of red shoes sketched in marker, a black and white sketch of a boy smiling wide, the only color, the red of his shoes. Some have quotes by boys in Amar's class. "These are the best shoes I've owned, Omar M. My parents were so kind to get me these shoes, Gabe M. I have not tripped once when wearing these, Michael C." Their favorite posters are the emotional appeals to Mama and Baba, written in big block letters. "Don't you want to make your only son and youngest child happy for once? After this, I promise to never ask for anything else. Last year for my birthday, I got a book. $120 is nothing if it buys so much happiness. We had enough money to get ugly new living room curtains." Just yesterday, Amar came home from school and announced that his best friend Mark had gotten new shoes. Mark was in Amar's third grade class and his first real friend. Amar often talked about Mark, how Mark was allowed to play video games every day, how Mark had the latest console. Mark got to eat in front of the TV. Baba told him that meant Mark was spoiled, not special. There was a rule in their house that Baba only let them bend on rare occasions. They were not allowed to go over to their friends' houses. They could only see them at school. Baba told them, "There is no such thing as friends, only family, and only family will never desert you." Hadia disliked it when Baba said this. It was untrue and unfair, especially because Baba had friends from work and friends from mosque, who he was closer to than Mama was to her few friends. And besides, Hadia thought, she had Danielle, who had been her friend since the first grade, and even now that they were in seventh grade and only saw each other during lunch or in PE, Danielle slowed her pace while running the mile to jog alongside Hadia. And if their classmates pointed to Hadia's head and asked her, "But aren't you dying under that thing?" it was Danielle who stood up to defend her. Danielle, who shouted back at them,
Does anyone ever ask you if you're dying in your clothes?
Hadia was the only girl in their grade who had never spent a night at a friend's house, had never spent a Saturday with one either. Swinging in the park, or wandering malls and trying on lip gloss and doing whatever else it was that girls did together. Instead, Hadia and Danielle shared a slam book that they decorated and filled with quizzes and journal entries written like letters to each other. And on weekends, Danielle called the house phone and Hadia would take the phone into her closet and pray to God that no one would pick up and listen in. And if Amar did, they had code names for everyone and their own version of Pig Latin. Still, sometimes Hadia wondered if it was true or possible that someone who was not in her family could ever really love her. Baba's words made her think of her home like a fortress they could only leave to go to school or mosque or to the home of a family friend who spoke their language. And in this fortress, she and her siblings were lucky, at least, to have each other. Last night before dinner, while Hadia was studying for her math test, Amar had knocked on her bedroom door and asked, "Do you think I should ask Baba to get the shoes for me?" Amar always trusted her to know how their parents would react to things that he had done or wanted to do, as though he were not also their child who could predict them. She felt guilty about how little patience she had for her brother now. She used to appreciate his lingering in her doorway, how he would pause between his stories, thinking of what to say next, as if just speaking to her was the important thing. She did not miss their old games, but did miss wanting to play them, wanting to run in their backyard together until she was out of breath. Amar felt it too. Sometimes the three of them would play again, but Hadia would find an excuse to cut the game short, or would injure her character and die a tragic death, despite her siblings begging her to find a cure.
"How much are they?" she asked.
$150, he mumbled so fast he blurred the numbers together. He watched her with a worried look on his face, as though her response would determine if he should have hope. It was never going to happen. Mama bought them shoes from the cheap shoe stores. They were allowed one pair a year, usually in the fall before school began, and they wore them until they became too tight or until the next school year.
"Definitely," she said, just so he would let her study in peace.
But when he jumped off her desk and almost ran out the room, she did not know why she had said it. That night at dinner, Amar looked up at Baba from time to time. Mama refilled bowls and brought the dishes out to the table, still steaming, rice and dal and talava gosh, the dishes she cooked so often. She poured more for Amar before taking a seat. Amar did not even thank her. Hadia reached across the table to help herself to more rice. And then Amar asked for the shoes. And because her home was given to arguments, in the way she imagined other homes might be given to laughter, Amar continued to ask even after Baba refused him, his pleas growing more desperate as Baba's request to not be tested turned into a firm command.
"Are these the $150 shoes?" Huda asked him.
Amar glared at Huda, then looked to Baba to see if he had reacted. Mama had stopped eating, but she did not look up from her plate. They knew Baba. Knew which of Baba's faces to not push further. Knew that his reaction depended on how stressful his day had been. But Amar never knew when to stop. Hadia wiped her hand on her napkin so she could reach beneath the table to pat him, to warn him before it was too late.
"Baba, just this once, can you?"
It was too late.
"Enough,"
Baba barked, and banged his hand on the table, and their dishes rattled. The light above them flickered. For a split second, There was nothing but dark, and the water in their glasses sloshed up before settling again.
"Do not ask me again,"
Baba yelled at him, his voice the rough and loud one, the one that made Hadia jump no matter how many times she had heard it, even when she expected it, even when it was not directed at her. In these moments, she hated her father. How the fury he was capable of contorted his features and made his skin flush red. The little gems that dangled from the chandelier trembled.
"There is no sense in shoes that are over $100. No sense," Baba said furiously.
Amar turned to Huda and spat out,
"I hate you."
"What did you say?"
Baba yelled.
"He said he hated me."
Huda sat up in her chair.
"I heard what he said,"
Baba snapped at her. Huda opened her mouth to argue, but saw how Baba glared at her. Even Mama looked at Huda angrily. And Hadia decided in that moment that she too hated them all. Her brother, who made everything difficult for himself. Her mother, who turned against her own children just to stand by her husband. Huda, with the smug look on her face, and how provoking Amar's anger was like a game to her. They were all cruel to each other. They could not even get through one dinner. She stared at the food on her plate and made a silent pact with herself. She would work hard. She would study. And she would find herself a new family. A new house that never got angry. A home where weeks would pass without a voice raised.
"What did you say, Amar?"
Baba asked Amar again. Amar stared at his plate. His face was blank. He pushed his plate forward. He lost his appetite so quickly. Hadia could see the way his eyes filled with tears, but he bit the inside of his cheek so he would not cry.
"Amar, I asked you a question," Baba shouted. "Look at me."
He did not look up. No one in their family was as stubborn as Amar. He was even more stubborn than their father. His lip quivered, and what had hardened in Hadia a moment ago suddenly softened. She did not hate him. She took back the thought, reached under the table, and placed her hand on his knee, pressed on it just a little.
"You never tell your sisters you hate them, do you understand?" Baba said, pointing his finger at Amar.
Amar still did not flinch.
"Did you hear me?"
Baba kept shouting. Underneath the table, out of sight, Amar placed his hand, so much smaller than hers, on top of Hadia's, and squeezed it. So when she wakes the next morning to see pamphlets with facts and testimonials slipped under their doors and posters taped all over the home, she is surprised. While the rest of them slept, Amar had taken a stack of Baba's good printer paper and begun his campaign. By midday, a petition circulates, 5 blank spaces under the line. "We, the people of our house, believe Amar deserves the shoes." Everyone signing their name, except Baba. Mama asks Amar to come to lunch, and Amar shouts from upstairs that he is protesting peacefully, and that means he will not eat, and Hadia is sent with a plate that she sets by his door. An hour later, it is found empty in the sink. And even though Baba had been so adamantly against Amar asking for the shoes last night, he remains silent during Amar's campaign. And Hadia wonders if he is curious to see how far Amar will go.
"I would like to deliver a speech,"
Amar announces at the head of the dinner table. Mama turns to Baba and touches his arm. "Let him," she says. "Let's see what he says."
Mama smiles.
She appears to be proud of him. Hadia is confused. How could she be amused by an inherently defiant act. They wait to see what Baba will say. Baba raises his eyebrows and extends his hand toward Amar, palm up, as if to say, "Well then, proceed." The gesture surprises Amar too. They take their seats at the dinner table, and Amar waits until they are quiet and facing him, before pulling a piece of binder paper from his pocket, unfolding it, coughing into his fist twice, like he had seen in some movie, and beginning to read. His hands shake. His voice trembles. He reminds everyone that Baba's signature is the only one missing from the petition. Then the rest of his speech is written in the form of a letter, addressed directly to Baba, telling Baba all the things Amar will do if his wish is granted. He holds the paper high, so his face is hidden, and Hadia looks from Mamma to Baba. They are both listening. There is a tenderness to their expressions. It seems very possible that Baba will grant him his wish. She has never thought to do anything like it, has never thought to continue to fight for what she wants after Baba has told her no. Hadn't she wanted a pet? Hadn't she wanted to go to the movies with Danielle? Wanted to read the book Mama said she was too young for after flipping through it and forbidding her? "I will try more on my spelling tests," Amar says. And at this, Baba leans forward and stops him. This year, Amar has gotten no more than 6 correct on a 20-word spelling test. His teacher has constantly sent letters home, concerned about his performance in various subjects, calling Mama Baba in for extra meetings. One more hour would be cut from Amar's television time. One more toy taken away. But he has never improved.
"Let's make a deal," Baba says.
Everyone blinks at Baba. Amar lowers his paper, nods eagerly. He is more surprised than any of them.
"If you get 100% on your next spelling test, I will get you the shoes."
"Done."
"Not one word misspelled."
"I can do it. I will."
"This week's test, Amar."
"Deal,"
Amar says, extending his hand. Baba takes his hand, and Amar shakes it solemnly, looking Baba in the eye. Then Baba claps his hands together and says, "Let's eat," before returning to his seat. And in that moment, her father seems like a gracious man, and Hadia looks up at him, and then again, in awe. On the morning of the test, they are almost late for school, because Amar refuses to get out of bed. Hadia and Huda hear him whining while they brush their teeth.
"I'm sick," he says. "I swear it, I can't go, I don't want to."
When Hadia peers in from the doorway, Mama is parting the curtain and Amar is hiding under his covers.
"You have to try," Mama says to him softly. "You have to at least try."
He peeks from the covers and relaxes a little when he sees Hadia, and Hadia tells him if he hurries, she will test him one last time in the car.
"But my sore throat," he says, touching his neck. "My dizzy feeling."
Mama pulls his covers away until he has no choice but to sit up, and she says, "Good boy," to him. "Good boy," using her gentlest voice as if he were still a baby, and Amar gets up slowly, still touching his throat in a last attempt to fool them.
"You're good at studying,"
Amar had told her the night he struck the deal.
"Can you help me?"
"It's a spelling test. You just have to memorize things."
"I know that," he said.
But he looked embarrassed, as if the thought had only just occurred to him.
"I just know that you get 100% on things."
In the few days leading up to the test, Amar came to her bedroom after school, holding the list of words and waiting for her instruction. It was so simple. She hardly had to help.
She glanced at him from time to time to see how often he looked at the wall, swayed in his seat, busied himself with something on the floor. But he was dedicated. He may have shifted in his chair, but he never left it. After he wrote out each word 10 times, he would ask her, "What now?" "Write them 10 times more, she told him. He did not doubt her or complain, as she anticipated he might. Each night she tested him. "Beautiful," she said, and watched him write it down. "Bookcase, photograph, analyze, cylinder, approximate, consequences." While she graded them, he bit the inside of his cheek, kicked his feet back and forth. 10 right, 10 wrong. When she told him that, he appeared sadder than she had ever seen, and she reassured him that he had another day to study. Hadia helped him come up with songs for the particularly difficult ones. He hummed as she tested him. The night before the actual test, she tested him again. He got them all right but one. Approximate. The one that had given him trouble since the beginning. "It is just one word," Hadia told him. "By morning you will have it memorized." "You really think so?" he asked her. "I really do," she said. She was glad she said it. It took so little of her, and it put him at ease, made him happy. But in the car, he is visibly worried. Hadia tests him the whole way, and he spells each word aloud. Still, he gets approximate wrong. "I'm so proud of you no matter what happens," Mama says to him. "I'm so happy you studied." Amar slams the car door and disappears behind the school gates. He becomes one of the hundreds of kids hurrying to make it before the late bell. And Hadia tries not to meet Mama's eyes, afraid that Mama will realize that she has not once, not ever, told Hadia she is proud of her for studying, even though it is all Hadia does. "I'm sure I got them all right," he says to her after school that day. "Thank you. The songs played in my head when I took the test." "What about approximate?" she asks. He is silent. He twists his mouth and presses his tongue against his cheek. Then he lifts his dirty white shoe and reveals its sole. "Approximate" is written on the heel in black pen. "I wrote it just in case, but I didn't really use it. I just checked to make sure I got it right." Hadia's breath catches in her. It had never occurred to her to cheat. "Qasam, you won't tell Baba?" "Qasam," she tells him. 3. By the time she has reached the bottom of the stairs, she has shaken the heaviness of sleep and now moves quickly, aware of the little time they have left to eat. 5th day of Ramadan, middle of the night. She flips rotis she rolled out last night. The heat of the stove dissolves the numbness of her face, her eyelids. One after another, and they rise, and she presses down with her spatula, feels the rush of heat as they deflate. In her tired state, the black spots appear like unique patterns. Hadia and Huda are used to fasting, but this is the first year that Amar, only 10, 5 years before his baligh age, is trying. The first 3 days, he kept half roza, broke it when Layla coaxed him with macaroni and sliced fruit, reminding him he was still too young. He could wait to assume the obligation that would last his lifetime. But last night, after she finished telling them stories about the Prophet's love for his grandson Hussein, a rare end to their nights now, he insisted he would fast the full day, and that she should wake him for Sehri.
She regards him as younger at 10 than her daughters seemed at 9, when they began wearing hijab and praying and fasting during Ramadan.
Were you two also that little then?
She wonders when she sees her daughters, now 13 and 14. The rotis are put into their box, and the lid sealed shut. Now she fries an egg for Rafiq, reheats leftover spinach for the children. She rinses a bunch of purple grapes. The month of Ramadan awakens a primal instinct in her. She is sensitive to how much her children eat, watches them drink a glass of water and then gulp milk, and still worries for them. Some nights, when she feels particularly affectionate toward her daughters for fasting, she piles the food on trays and carries them, either to the girls' beds or to a corner in her room, where they huddle and feast half awake in the night. She does not know why Ammar decided this was the year he would try to keep fasts. More perplexing is that it seems he genuinely wants to, despite fasting being the most difficult and tiring ritual for the body. "First begin to pray," she had told him. "First, stop bothering your sisters so much. First, learn to control your anger." But who was she to say no? What was the phrase? "Beggars cannot be choosers." If this was how he wanted to participate, she would support him. She would make it easier for all of them. She would let them stay up at night, if it meant they were snacking and not waking her or Rafiq. Let them sleep in during the day. She would plan the meals that broke their fast around their tastes. This was the month she allowed them takeout days in a row, endless helpings of dessert. She wondered if Ammar's recent insistence might be because his friend, Abbas, Seema's boy, had just turned 15 and begun fasting himself. Layla liked him and his younger brothers much more than she liked Seema, partly because of how much their friendship meant to her son, but also because Abbas always made a point to say salam to her, and he dipped his head in that respectful way before joining Ammar outside. Or maybe her son was just reacting to Ramadan, a month so holy, she was sure it softened the heart of every believer. She is startled when she hears Rafiq's footsteps. Sometimes he wakes with enough time for them to prepare Sehri together, and they stumble about the kitchen. Other times, it is just her, turning on only the lights she needs to see the space before her. "Let's eat upstairs," she says. And he nods his slow, half-asleep nod and brings out the trays. Layla sets glasses on one tray and pours water in some and milk in the others, ever conscious of the ticking clock, anxious there will be no time left for her children to eat before being hungry all day.
"We don't need to wake Ammar," Rafiq says when she counts out 5 plates.
He lifts the heavier tray.
"But he insisted he wants to."
"He doesn't need to yet."
"Shouldn't we encourage him?"
"On any other day, yes. Tomorrow is going to be the hottest day of the summer, the longest roza, and he's still going to want to play basketball."
She returns a plate to the shelf and follows with the second tray. Sometimes he surprises her with his lenience. Other times, it is his strict adherence that unsettles her. She could guess, but could never accurately predict where he would stand on a matter. They set down the trays in their room, and Rafiq begins to divide food onto the plates. Layla goes to wake the girls. Ammar will be so angry in the morning when he realizes no one woke him. "You promised you would, you promised." She would hear it all day. Promises meant more to Ammar, and she had no doubt he would refuse breakfast, refuse lunch, and if he ate, it would only be in secret. She does not want another day disrupted by his bad behavior, the domino effect it has on Hadia and Huda. Yesterday, there had been one of those bizarre, rare, hot summer thunderstorms.